Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Have you been thinking about litter boxes today? Well, if you haven't, we're going to talk about litter boxes and a few other things as well as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll also talk a bit about getting your pets through the rest of the holidays and, of course, answer all of your pet health questions. So hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. And please post, if you've got some photos of your cat or your dogs, we'd always love to see them on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
Oh, it's so nice to be here at the end of the year.
Yeah, the end of the year. And you know, the whole year, I'm sure there have been many a time when you've had to deal with cat litter boxes.
Oh, my goodness. It's not just, it is an everyday occurrence in the veterinary world. And you know, there are so many simple things that we can do. But, you know, the first thing is, if you have a cat that is not using the litter box for whatever reason, it really needs to be evaluated from a medical standpoint first, meaning get your cat in, make sure that there isn't something wrong with your kitty, bladder irritation, bladder stones, diabetes, kidney disease, hyperthyroidism, all these things that can make a cat have problems with using the litter box. But there are so many things that we can do to prevent problems, especially if it comes down to problems because of our management. And so that is my goal, is to have every cat have the golden litter box for, you know, like make it the best litter box you can possibly make for them to help prevent problems, because one in four cats at some point during their life stops using the litter box. And in some cases, it can be a life and death thing. We see a lot of cats that are relinquished to the shelter because they don't use their litter box, and it may be some things that can be very simply fixed.
Well, you know, I have when friends come to visit and see my litter box for the kitties, they go, "Whoa, I've never seen a litter box that big." And it is a pretty good sized one, and I took your advice.
Yep. And that is one of the things that the commercial litter boxes that are for sale in the pet store are way too small. Most cats are just big, you know, big enough either because just their body size is big, or they're overweight and have a hard time moving around in it. Hopefully that would be something that owners can correct. But it needs to be at least 1.5 times the length of the cat from the tip of their nose to their back end. And so go to the pet store and measure your cat and then start looking at litter boxes. And you're going to find they're not really, even the jumbo ones out there aren't big enough. Yeah. I mean, when you look at cats, they are desert animals. They originated in the desert where they had the entire desert to go to the bathroom in. And now we're confining that sandy desert to a little tiny, tiny box. So we want to make it big enough so they can move around easily. And so what I like to see people use are under the bed storage bins, you know, any of the things that you can buy that don't necessarily have a cat photo on it, but you can get them inexpensively, modify them to make it easy for the cat to get in and out. And that's obviously the number one thing, is make sure that it's big enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And the type of litter, my cats don't seem to be too fussy. But
some cats are. And so if we have a cat that's not using the litter box, one of the things that we always do is look at what's put in the box. And we know that the bigger the granule size, the less the acceptance. So some of those litters that are out there, I had somebody in the other day that was using the wood pellets from a wood stove. And they said because they can buy big bags of it very inexpensively, and that it's absorbent. And it's like, yeah, it would be. But, you know, I kind of equate it to, would you rather walk on a beach that's covered with pebbles or a nice soft sandy beach? And so here we've got these kitties that are trying to move these really coarse pellets, and it's hard for them to dig and make a hole versus if it's in sand. So soft, scoopable, sandy litter seems to be what is accepted the best. There really isn't any research to show that scent makes any difference. But if you have a cat that isn't using their box, going to something that maybe is an unscented litter, there's a little bit of evidence to show that The cats like the litter that is either like the carbon-based litter versus baking soda-based litter. So you'll find some that have baking soda in it, some that have charcoal in it to help with odor control. And there's been a little bit of sway towards the charcoal, but not much.
No, yeah. I use the other, and it works fine.
And it's fine. And I wouldn't recommend changing it if it's something that your cat likes. And that's something that you have to go about changing slowly, too. It, just like we do with diet, you want to change litters slowly if you're going to change to something brand new that the cat may not be comfortable with.
I wish I could place mine in a different spot than where it is.
Oh, you know, and that's the other thing, is cats often pick their own location of where they want it. The big things to be thinking about are cat, it shouldn't be near their food. They need to have easy access to be able to get to it. And so taking that litter box and putting it down in the basement next to the furnace or the water softener that may be scary for the cat could be a problem. If that cat has some urgency, they're not going to troop all the way down in the basement when that comforter or that carpet is nice and absorbent. So that gets to another thing, is how many litter boxes do you have? For two cats, a minimum of 3 litter boxes, and that is ideal, where you have them in different locations in your home. And unfortunately, that may mean in a spot where you're, as you have guests come in, they may say, oh, you've got a litter box here. But if that's where your cat is preferred to go, because they can maybe have good escape potential. If the doorbell rings, they can see who's there. Is it something scary that's coming, so they can get away? Especially if you've got dogs and cats together, or maybe a cat living in a home with a cat that's a bully, they need to be able to get away quickly if they can assess that somebody else is coming. So having it hidden in a closet kind of defeats that purpose, because now they're cornered and they can't get away. And they're going to pick a spot out in the open to go.
And mine's uncovered. Ours.
Those covered boxes typically are for the owner. What you don't see and you don't smell, you don't clean. And so, yes, it may help keep the litter in the box a little bit better, but there are things that you can do with perhaps using a storage bin that you've cut an entry hole out of, you've left the lid off of, so the cat can get in but still have a way of being able to get out of there. I've seen bully cats sit on top of the covered box and not let the other cat out, so why would they go in there? They're going to pick the kitchen counter or your bed or something like that to be able to go on. And so I've also seen owners that are a little negligent. If you don't see that it's dirty, you may not clean it. And so those covers, again, are something for us and not for the cat. So I prefer an uncovered box if I could get one.
And we have some photos online on our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show, right kind of in the middle of the page, that are just photos. And Jill put these up. Jill,
yeah, and they're showing a lot of different things, like a covered box with a small hole. Well, again, some cats, if they're especially a single cat household, may do fine. There's a storage bin that they've left the lid on. Again, if you've got a cat that is a little claustrophobic or can't move around and turn, it could be a problem.
That one looks like it's hard to get into.
Well, they've put a litter box here, and what they've done is they put a shield around the outside, and that would be for what I call the elevator butt cats, you know, where they tend to start out squatting and may start lifting their rear end up. And something like that may not be too bad, but you can take a plastic bin and modify it just the same way by cutting away some of the sides. Here they've given a kitty there's other things like little mats and things that probably aren't going to be a problem for the cat to get in and out. They just kind of trap the litter, and that's a great way, rather than having a covered box, something to be able to trap the litter to make cleanup easier for the owner. And then what you use to clean the litter box is really important. Using harsh chemicals, things like bleach or, you know, really smelly things that you may find pleasant, but that pine scent or that lemon scent may be something that the cat might find aversive. So, you know, just washing it out with soap and water when you're going to clean, so you're not leaving a strong scent behind. Would be helpful.
Yeah, and I sort of clean the poop and so forth out on a daily basis. I do it once a day typically.
And that's, for most cats, that's fine. We have some cats that are such neat freaks that they need to have it cleaned more often. And that's where having multiple litter boxes, one more than cat, if you can't get to it to clean it, now you've got that opportunity for them finding a clean toilet. And so it just increases the odds that you're going to have less of an issue with them, turning their nose up at a dirty box.
Yeah. Well, even when I, every time I clean clean it, then Tiger has to go in.
Oh, yeah. That's that clean bathroom. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Diane in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Diane. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. And I volunteered at a cat shelter, so I can attest to the fact that so many people need to hear this show. It's really great that you're doing this. But here's my situation. I'm trying to do a preemptive strike. I've adopted a 14-year-old hyperthyroid cat. She's been isolated in a separate room because she had a viral infection, and I'm getting ready to let her assimilate with the other guys. The situation is that she also has failing kidneys, so she, like, pees all the time. So right now, I clean her box about 3 times a day. She mm-hmm. also has pretty soft stools. I don't want the other cat stepping in her her bowel movement, and I also want to make sure that she is going to the boxes that I have. I have a two-level house, so on my main level, I just have one box, and it's worked out. I don't want to put another box and then take it away at some point in time, but what would your suggestions be?
Well, I think the first step is going to be introducing this cat to the other cats. You don't want her to get stressed where she goes off and hides and isn't drinking or eating, because that's going to push her over the brink and can cause her kidney disease to get worse or cause behavior problems with her not being able to get to the litter box. So what I would suggest to start with is take those other cats and isolate them into another room where she can come out and start exploring and finding out where all the litter boxes are located, the smells of the other cats, really good hiding spots, how to climb up and down the cat tree, you know, just so that she gets the lay of the land, because the other cats obviously know everything and she's the newbie. So give her a chance to kind of get used to the place. Then I would put her back in the other room, let the other cats out, they can start seeing that, oh, somebody else has been here. And you do this very, very gradually. And this may not be something that's going to work out well for her. And I really worry about, so a lot of older cats really are not that adaptable. And with all of her strikes against her, it could really backfire. So, you know, if you do this, when you are introducing them, I would even consider doing things like putting bells on the other cat so that she has a little early warning signal that somebody else is approaching if she's a little skittish and she can get away. You know, I'd be also investigating why her stools are soft. It could be that if her hyperthyroidism isn't well regulated, that could be causing her to have softer stools. And so making sure that that is well controlled. And I'm sure that now that you're the new owner, that's something that you're going to be seeking veterinary advice to make sure that that's well controlled. And also be looking for other reasons, like, is it a diet change? Is it new parasites? Does she need to be? And obviously having kidney disease is going to need to be fed separately from the other cats, because she should be on a specialized diet to help support those that kidney health. So there's going to be a lot of changes that you're going to have to make, including meal feeding, not leaving food out all the time, making sure that you have plenty of litter boxes, and it may mean adding in more litter boxes since you've brought this other cat in, and expecting her to be able to adapt where the location is of the boxes that your current cats are using may be a little much. And so, you know, let her have her own personal space. I've had people go as far as putting in a cat door that the cat wears a little magnet on into like a hollow core door into a bedroom where she has her own escape zone that she can go into that the other cats can't follow her. And that would be something that's fairly easy to train a cat to go through a door like that. And then the other cats will leave her alone and she's got her own personal space. So, you know, kind of thinking a little bit about things like that where she has those spots that she can get away may make things a little bit easier.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're taking a look at your beautiful kitties and dogs with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Go right to the phones again and to Jessica in Madison. Jessica, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat. I actually have two cats, but one of them has strong anxiety, and I feel like we have tried everything, so I'm going to explain what's going on, and I'll just curious if this sounds behavioral because we've done so many medical things, and he's still defecating on the floor 1 to 4 times a day. We have had him have 2 ultrasounds. He's had his enzymes checked. He's had his fecal matter checked for parasites. We've literally had everything checked, and they think that he maybe has a thickening of his intestines and that he might have irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for him to, it's hard for them to tell without going in and scraping, I guess, which is, I guess, our next step if whatever we're trying isn't working. But we have tried several things, 3 different litter boxes with unscented litter that that are in different spaces in the house. We have him on a probiotic. We have him on Prozac for his anxiety. We have him on prednisolone. And he tends to go more often on the floor when we leave the house or when he's upset about something, such as this morning we gave him his medicine, which he doesn't like. He went straight down to the litter boxes and went outside of them. Kind of, we're thinking maybe he's saying, don't do that to me. We're not sure. But because sometimes his fecal matter can be very tiny and strained and very small, so we're thinking that's also painful for him. And other times it can be soft serve. So, we're just wondering if it sounds like it could be more behavioral. It has been about 3 years that this has been going on. And then for about a few months before I had our first baby in July, he pretty much stopped going on the floor. And then when we brought the new baby home, he started again. And
added
it's been
stress.
Worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, number one is no punishment. It's really uncommon for kitties that have a litter box aversion problem or, you know, problem with the litter box itself to not be urinating and defecating out of the box. To just see them defecating out of the box typically starts as a medical problem. Either they're constipated and it hurts, or they have inflammatory bowel disease and they have diarrhea and they may have some urgency, or they have impacted anal gland issues. And then once it starts as a medical problem, it can turn into a behavior problem. And if he is going next to the litter box, I mean, so he's going down in that vicinity, then I would look at providing him with something that maybe he can go on that would make cleanup easier. And I've had people use things like putting the litter box itself on top of one of those trays that you can get at the you know, home improvement stores that are used to go underneath washing machines in case they spring a little leak. They have about a 1-inch lip, and they're about the size of your standard washing machine, so they're big and square, and it would hold just about any size litter box that you can have. And that way he has something else that he can go on that does not have litter in it. So is this just a superstitious behavior? I think you really need to get to the bottom of this behavior problem and or his gut problem, I should say, to find out, is this a medical problem? Because, you know, if his stool consistently is changing from being, you know, dry and hard to pass to diarrhea, he sounds like he may need to have either endoscopy with biopsies done or an exploratory with biopsies done. There's different techniques that are used kind of depending on the comfort level of your veterinarian, but that's probably going to get you the most answers. And I always worry anytime a problem has gone on this length of time, how much of it is habit. 3 years to be dealing with something like this is a long time. And so expecting it, even if you do get his gut situation under control, to reverse itself may be difficult. Try giving him something else. It's not going to make you quite as upset if he's gone next to the box, like one of these trays. Some people will put in the absorbent pads that they use for like housebreaking dogs and to make clean up a little bit easier. I've even had people use a giant litter box, such as a kitty's swimming pool, to, you know, put litter in it. And yes, it's big and it's round and it's going to take up a lot of floor space, but sometimes that even helps as well. So start looking into doing things like that and maybe accepting the fact that the litter box issue may be a lifetime problem, but what can we do to make his gut feel better? And I'd be following your veterinarian's instructions on that. And if they're thinking biopsy is the next step, then definitely that would be the way to go.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Dean in Cedarburg next. Hi, Dean.
Yeah, hi. Question. One thing I want to comment. We have 2 large cats, and we went to Home Depot to buy the litter boxes. They were really meant to be used for mixing cement.
Yep.
But my question is, we were using a clay-based litter for a long time, and it just, I just started to realize how nasty that is because it raises dust, and the dust settles everywhere in the house, and you know what gets spilled on the linoleum floor near it. It's why that's hard, because you mix it with water and you just leave a thin layer of clay on the floor when you're cleaning the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what you suggest.
Well, there are some other clumping type litters that do not use clay. There's some that use ground corn, and that brand happens to be called World's Best Cat Litter. And again, some cats really like that. There's some paper-based litters that are not pelletized, but there's small little teeny nuggets, and I think it's called Paypure that you could find. There are some cedar-based litters as well that are little teeny tiny pieces like that are the, like a wood-based litter. Some cats don't like that, and so you have to be really careful, and I always say put a litter box next to your current litter box with the new stuff in it and let the cat decide, is this something I want to use or not. If they are insisting on using clay, there are some clay-based litters that are less dusty than others, and you're going to pay a premium for them, but they are a relatively dust-free litter. But that's the issue with these clumping litters, is they are made from a type of clay that can form cement in water. That's why it clumps together, and why you can't flush it down the toilet, and why it sticks to the floor if it gets wet. And this would be the case of using I have in front of all of my litter boxes rugs that I can shake out, and that's just part of my weekly house cleaning, is to, you know, take those rugs, lift them out, and shake them outside so that the litter is out there rather than in the house, and just being good at sweeping and vacuuming before you start mopping floors. And but I agree, the dust can be a real problem, and I deal with that myself, and I wish there was something else that I could use, but that is my cat's favorite litter, and so I'm kind of stuck with using it, and because I have tried other things as well.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I use I think it's Arm & Hammer.
Yeah, and that's that's usually a sodium bentonite clay, they call it, and it's
that doesn't seem to dust.
It doesn't. You can find experiment, and that's you've probably found one that looks pretty good. I've used one right now that is Fresh Step is what I happen to be using in my litter boxes, and it may just be the area that I have one of my boxes, but where I see the dust accumulating is a little bit of a problem. So,
interesting.
Okay. Well,
all right. Thanks a lot for calling, Dean. Appreciate it. Judy and Madison, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Dr. Sadchuk.
Hello.
Lovely to talk to you again. You saved the life of my previous dog's life, so I really appreciate your advice.
Well, thank you.
Yes. I currently have a 5-year-old Havanese, and he was limping, and I took him to the vet, and it turns out he's got weak knees, so we had an orthopedic consult who recommended a patellar luxation repair.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, how successful is that surgery?
It very successful, especially if you're dealing, an orthopedic surgeon is looking at approaching these knees. But it is a very successful surgery. There's various grades of patellar luxation. And what the patella is the kneecap. And for the majority of dogs, that kneecap should sit in a nice groove and move, when the knee bends, just slide up and down in that groove. But for some dogs, it slips inward or medially. And so you'll see these dogs walking or running fine, and then all of a sudden they start limping and walking three-legged lame, and then they wiggle their leg a little bit, it pops back in, and off they go again. And so depending on how severe the luxation is, there's various approaches that the surgeons use. Sometimes if it's very mild, they can just put in a big, almost like the surgeons listening to this are probably going to cringe, but a big pleat on the outer surface of the joint to kind of pull everything over and tighten it up. Sometimes they, what they can do is deepen the groove that the patella sits in, so they actually open the joint and go in there and deepen that groove so that the patella now has something that it can ride in. And in really severe cases where maybe that knee has been out of place for a long time and everything is out of place, they sometimes have to do some surgery where they take some of the bone off of the tibia, the lower part of the leg bone, and slide everything over and reattach it. And so there's various levels that have to be done, and it all really depends on the severity of your dog's knee issues. But it tends to be one of the more successful surgeries that we can do, especially if you do it in a younger dog before they start getting secondary arthritis.
Okay, well, I appreciate that information, and now the big decision has to be made.
Okay,
there you go.
Good luck.
Good luck, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. Jane emailed that she called in a month or two ago about her 14-year-old male cat drinking and urinating excessively. Healthy otherwise, always uses the litter box, had been thoroughly examined. All the labs showed nothing wrong. On your recommendation, she took him back to the vet and had early renal disease lab test. All labs were repeated, including urine sugar and other lab work. Still, nothing shows wrong. What would be the next thing to check?
Oh, my goodness. You know, this would be a case where if they've been following everything, and I didn't see anything there about having a thyroid level checked, but that would be definitely something that I would be looking into. So looking at those lab tests, did your veterinarian run a T4 level, which is the thyroid level that we typically run on kitties that we're suspicious of maybe being hyperthyroid? That would be something to be looking at as well. The other thing is, I don't see anything about them checking a urine sample. I'm wondering if they did do a urine check on this cat. They've done all this blood work, but did they actually look at the urine? I hope they did. But, you know, if everything's been looked at and they cannot find any answers, this may be the time to be looking at getting a second opinion. And in my practice, I am very lucky that I can just walk down the hall. Not every day, because sometimes they're very busy, but we have a whole fleet of internists that deal with these things on a daily basis, and I present all my lab work and the physical findings of the patient and sometimes get their feedback to see, because sometimes that extra set of eyes on that blood work and your analysis is really helpful, because sometimes we miss things that are quite obvious to somebody else. So it may be time for a second opinion. I really don't have any other answers for her. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to Claire in Madison then. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk.
Hello.
I'm so grateful to get through. This just happened over, naturally, Christmas weekend. I have a roughly 10-year-old Corgi. I'm not sure of his exact age because he's a Humane Society doggy, Corgi mix. But he had a fatty-looking cyst right under the surface of his skin. It kind of looked like a giant gumdrop. He's had that for months and months, and the vet looked at it this last summer and said, I'm not concerned. It's not in his muscle. I don't think we should mess with it. Just leave it alone and keep an eye on it. And Saturday, Christmas Eve, he was out doing his business in the yard, and I looked at his leg, and oh, my God, that thing looked like it had grown exponentially overnight.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in right away on Monday with the vet, and she took one look at his leg and said, we've got to do surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And she removed, it was huge, she said, huge. I guess my question is, could something originally benign and it was not biopsied the first time, tissue will be biopsied from the surgery yesterday, mm-hmm. but can something benign become malignant?
Well,
or is this potentially two different things?
Well, we don't know if it was benign before, because did your veterinarian do a needle biopsy or a needle aspirate of the original mass when it was small?
Unfortunately, he did not.
Okay. And that's the problem, is just by looking at something, you can't tell what it is. And there's a couple of different types of skin tumors that I see in my practice that can look rather quiet, but come back as something more evil when we do a needle biopsy. One of them is a soft tissue sarcoma, and they can grow really rapidly. They can sit there quietly for a while and then suddenly grow. The other is something called a mast cell tumor, M-A-S-T, and they, if they get bumped, can sometimes get quite large, and they can get, you know, bigger very, very quickly. And so I'm glad that this is being biopsied now and being looked at. Unfortunately, it should have probably been looked at before. And I don't let any lump go unpoked. I think we really need to. I keep body maps of all my patients, and we measure them with calipers so that we know how big they are. We'll put a little needle in it. It's not painful. Get some of the cells out to look under the microscope to see if we've got anything abnormal. If it comes back as fat or just as a cyst, then it's something that we know we can just sit and watch and wait and maybe not have to worry about for the rest of the pet's life. But we see so often these quiet things turning into something worse because we didn't know what they were to begin with. So I'm glad that it's taken care of now. Call us back next month and let us know what the biopsy is, because depending on what it is, your dog may need follow-up surgery to get wider margins. The dog may need some follow-up radiation, chemotherapy to be able to prevent recurrence as well. Hopefully it was curative and your dog's never going to look back. And even though it got big, your veterinarian was able to get it all. And I hope that that's the case.
Yeah, for sure. And Sandy's on January 24th next time.
I will definitely call on January 24th. Thank you, Doc.
You're welcome.
Right. Thanks a lot for calling. We have, let's see, let's go to Lewis in Milwaukee. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, my name is Lewis, and I'm calling from Milwaukee. Thank you so much for taking the time, Sandy.
Sure, no problem.
I have a eight-month-year-old hound dog. He was adopted from a shelter, and he's a very kind and very loyal dog. And I've noticed that he's very fearful of sudden loud noises, as well as anything that falls to the ground. He gets very fearful of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he is so young, and I just wanted to know if there's anything that we can help him kind of get over those fears and to prevent, really, any future aggression in him or just any future prolonged anxiety in the dog.
Yeah, so good that you're thinking about this now while he's young, because people will often leave this until it becomes much more difficult to take care of. And the big question is, with him being a rescue, we don't know what his background was. Was he like in a kennel, not exposed to a lot of things, and now all these noises are loud things that he's afraid of? Or is this genetic? We do see certain lines of dogs that this tends to be an issue for them, where they become noise phobic. So things that I would be trying to do is, number one, giving him a safe place that he can go and hide in your house, where it's kind of, I call it the bomb shelter, where it's some place that he can feel comfortable, whether it's a crate with a blanket over it, that, or, you know, a closet with a bed in it, or some place that he can go where he's going to feel that no one's going to disturb him or bother him. I also, you know, be careful that you're not encouraging the behavior by coddling him and saying, oh, you poor doggy, you know, because that's just going to, again, tell him that this is something really to be afraid of, because look at I'm getting, you know, my behavior is being encouraged. You may want to talk to your veterinarian now about medication. The reason why we start some of these really skittish dogs on medication early is that the earlier you start them on something, the better the chance are that they are then going to be able to become desensitized to these sounds, and you'll have a dog that can get off of medication and lead a normal life. And so when I'm talking about medications, things that we'll use are drugs like in the Valium type line, something like Xanax, Alprazolam is often used. We'll get these, and that's typically more for if you can anticipate a situation where the dog may be experiencing some sounds, but it's not one of those drugs where we want to have the dog on it day in and day out. The drugs that we would use and, you know, where we'd want to treat them every day would be things like fluoxetine or Prozac. Clomipramine would be another one, and they're all licensed for dog use and very, very safe to be able to use, especially in a young dog with no underlying health problems. There is some medication if you're looking at just a quick-acting thing that you can use, like maybe a thunderstorm's coming up and you have to, or 4th of July fireworks, which we're not anticipating for a while, but there's a new product on the market called Celio that's a transmucosal gel that works extremely well, at least in my hands. I've had very good success with it. I have a dog that's noise phobic with thunderstorms, and it's allowed me to be able to get some sleep. And you can use it even when they are already anxious. It only lasts for a couple of hours, so it's not a long-term thing, and that's where the daily medication may be something you have to consider. The other drug that we'll sometimes use is one called Trazodone. But these are all prescription medications, and so it would be something to talk to your veterinarian about and say, hey, I want to do something to give my dog some better quality of life, and, you know, getting them on some of these medications is probably going to be helpful. And then, you know, you can start small with maybe having a noise happen in another room while you're giving your dog treats, and having them sit and be comfortable and happy where they're relaxed, and then gradually that noise gets a little bit louder. And hopefully over time, you're going to have a dog that just blows it off like, hey, you know, no problem. It's just, you know, something dropping on the floor, and they recover very quickly. But your dog may always be a little skittish if they never got that good early socialization.
Yeah, there
great.
We go.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Joanne in Delafield has a question for you, Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Joanne.
Hi there. I'm wondering what Dr. Sawchuk thinks about the self-cleaning litter boxes. I've had pretty good luck with one with the rake, except sometimes the rake gets full of their poop and then it gets all clogged.
Yeah.
That's a huge problem. That is really a huge problem, is failure, and they don't clean. So my big concerns with them are, number one, the litter holding space, even in some of those ones that they claim to be, you know, bigger litter boxes, are still too small for your average cat. And so they have a hard time moving around in them, which may be why your cats are leaving stool that is not being covered with litter if they're having a hard time digging and moving around in it. So that's my big concern, is the fact that they just aren't big enough. Number two would be the noise that they make. If you have more than one cat and all of a sudden it's in clean mode while cat number two needs to use it, is it going to scare them? There's several designs on the market, ones that rake. There's one that actually rolls. If you look, you know, just even Google self-cleaning litter boxes, it looks like a front-loading washing machine. And it's, again, a circular type thing, holds very little litter and can be a problem. There's some that are the self-cleaning that are hooked to your plumbing in your bathroom, and actually they flush. They add water and a cleaning solution. It's a non-absorbent pellets that are in there, and then there's a dryer that dries them. And I encourage all of you to read the reviews on these, because if you need a belly laugh, that is just, oh my goodness, what people have gone through when they failed and come home to the dryer drying, you can imagine, you know, liquefied cat fecal material as we're heading into lunch hour. But I think that if you want a cat, you need to deal with a litter box. And the self-cleaning boxes are really something that I think is for the lazy pet owner, and you need to get in there and clean yourself. That way you can tell, is the cat producing normal amounts of urine? What's the consistency of the fecal material? Rather than having the box take care of it, there's a lot of stuff that you're going to be able to tell about the health of your cat by what you find in the litter box. So clean it yourself and save your money, and that gives you a lot of cat toys and wonderful cat treats and so on, instead of buying those expensive boxes.
All right.
Great.
great advice. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Julie in Mount Horeb. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a dog who's almost 17, and she has some blood in her urine. The vet has treated her for UTI, and we're in our second round of antibiotics, but I'm noting more blood again. So the vet's talking about possibly checking her blood pressure. She's already on high blood pressure medicine, or about a possible bladder cyst. Now, she has a low pH, so I think that has to be treated surgically, but I didn't know if there were any other options, because it's almost 17. I don't really want her to have surgery.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you mean by a bladder cyst, but things that I would be looking at are if she has a urinary tract infection, did it get cultured, and are you using the appropriate antibiotic for the right length of time, and then did you culture after you were done to make sure that the infection was totally cleared? It's kind of the standard treatment for a urinary tract infection that is, you know, bacterial. Other things that I would be concerned about is, yes, does she have something like bladder stones? And depending on the type of stone that may be there, some of them need to be surgically removed. Some can be dietarily dissolved. It's a therapeutic diet that you would have to get through your veterinarian. May not be appropriate for your dog. If your dog is hypertensive, these stone dissolving diets tend to be extremely high in salt and may not be health-wise the wisest move for your dog. So, dealing with bladder stones is often a surgical type thing, especially in the older dog. Lastly, I get concerned about things like bladder wall tumors. And this would be where if they were doing a urinalysis, they could look at the sediment and see, do they have any abnormal cells there or cells that are the lining cells of the bladder that are in higher number than they should be? They're called transitional cells. And getting an ultrasound done of your dog is probably one of the least invasive ways of being able to determine, is there a bladder stone in there? How big is it? Is it something that's going to be able to be passed on its own? Do we have a normal bladder wall, or do we have an area that looks like we've got a bladder tumor growing? So I think some more diagnostic work is going to be in the works before you ever even consider sending your dog to surgery.
Sure.
And when we see a dog that is forming bladder stones with very acidified urine, that typically means that they may have an issue with calcium oxalate stones, and that one is not able to be dissolved dietarily, so you're looking at surgery. So, it's a tough decision, but you can have a dog that's 17 and still physically able to handle anesthesia. Remember, age isn't a disease, and if your dog is able to handle anesthesia, it may be able to give your dog a comfortable senior life for however long that may be.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, they're talking low pH, and she was recommending an x-ray of the area versus an ultrasound.
An x-ray is going to be able to show up bladder stones. Not all of them, but there's two. There's some that don't show up on x-ray, but there's some that do. And the two main ones that we see in dogs typically do show up on x-ray, but often you can't tell the difference between them looking at them on an x-ray. Sometimes you can tell by the type of crystals they may be passing in a fresh urine sample to give you some idea of what those stones may be. So that may be one of those things that they can look at, combination of an x-ray and a fresh urinalysis to see what the crystals are. If they don't see anything visible bladder stone-wise, then you're looking at an abdominal ultrasound or a bladder ultrasound.
Yeah, there we go. All right, good luck.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Sherry in Whitewater will turn to you next. Hi, Sherry. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have an 11-and-a-half-year-old Maltese Shih Tzu who got a lump on her back, and our doctor did a needle aspiration and said it was a spacious cyst. And that we didn't have to worry about it. And then several months after that, it burst open. And over the last 8 months or so, it continues to almost heal, and then it fills back up and drains again. And so we're kind of keeping her in a wrap. that we change every day with God. Is this ever going to resolve, or does it ever turn into something scary?
Well, the big thing when we see a cyst is that sometimes they will just sit there quietly and not bother the dog for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden they reach kind of a critical pressure, and the best way for them to get rid of that pressure is to break through the skin and start draining. And what you're seeing is the cyst wall is still there, so it may heal over, and then it starts refilling with contents again, and then it ruptures again or starts draining again. So this is a case where surgical intervention is probably in your dog's best interest. Getting that cyst removed, because if you leave it there and it's continually opening and draining, you're going to end up with a pretty nasty infection, a lot of scar tissue around it. It's going to make drainage more difficult, and it's going to become itchier and more painful for your dog. So I think consider getting it removed. You've been dealing with it long enough, and I think 8 months is long enough for this, you know, to give Mother Nature a chance to see if it's going to heal up. It's time to get this thing removed.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Troy on Facebook says his dog's been pulling out his fur from his backside. He's been on off prednisone and the cone of shame. He has also done anti-itch spray to help him feel better. He's heard that coconut oil added to his food can help with his coat. Is it safe? Any other ideas on how to keep him from pulling out his fur?
The number one reason why dogs pull their hair out over their rump is flea allergy dermatitis, fleas. And it is one of those things where even now, in the middle of winter, I'm seeing cases of fleas coming into the vet school. The reason is that fleas lay eggs, and those eggs hatch. And so if you've got raccoons or possums coming through your yard, stray cats, your dog goes out there in the fall, and maybe you're thinking, I don't have to use my flea and tick medication anymore. All it takes is them picking up a flea or two, and now you can have a problem in your home. And when we see dogs with fleas, they typically are not covered with them. We may, if we're really lucky, just find one or two or maybe evidence of flea dirt. And so when we've got dogs with that type of pattern for itching, we automatically jump to your dog has a flea problem and needs to be taken care of. And so putting your dog on a topical or an oral flea and tick product that you get from your veterinarian, I'd be avoiding some of the over-the-counter things. But remember, the fleas that you may see on your pet today are from eggs that were laid a couple of months ago. And so that could have been, we had warm enough weather 2 months ago that we could have still had fleas outside in the environment. If you now have them in your home, it's very important that you treat for a minimum of 2 to 3 months. And that means every animal in the household be treated. We can see some that develop flea allergies and others that can live with fleas that don't even scratch and they're not bothered at all. So if you've got more than one pet and one isn't being bothered, that does not rule out fleas. So get them on a product that's recommended by your veterinarian. I typically like the oral products like NexGard, Bravecto, Simparica. Those are the three that are available. But even things like Frontline, Advantix, those would be excellent products to consider as well. A Seresto collar, which lasts for about 8 months, so you don't have to think about it come spring. Any of those things would be fine. And the other benefit is that even though we don't think that we can have tick problems, all it takes is weather like we had yesterday where it was in the 40s. Was it yesterday or the day before? I kind of lost track. But, you know, when we have weather that is in the 40s, those upper 30s or, 40-degree temperatures, that's the type of weather that ticks love to come out, and we have tick blooms. And so we see ticks even in January and February. So I think every dog living in Wisconsin needs to be on year-round flea and tick control, and this is a prime example of why.
There we go. Tom and Nina has another issue, I believe. Hi, Tom.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
First-time caller. Hey, I got a question. I have a 4-year-old male golden retriever. He's my hunting partner. He came from hunting lines for the golden retriever. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at maybe adding another puppy, and I'm wondering about dew claws. I saw on one site the lady, she does not have them removed. She she feels that, and I looked up a report on it, that when you remove that dew claw, like the tendons or whatever in that area, as it heals and they get older, aren't as strong. But then also you look at leaving them on, if they get tore off, it could be a problem.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what's your stance on.
Dew claws are kind of like our thumb. And the only time I think that they really need to be removed is when they are what we call a non-articulating dew claw. So looking at your hand and the bones in your thumb, imagine that you only have the bone where your nail is and the rest of it is just fleshy. That would be the type of dew claw that's just going to flop around and get caught on things. And those need to be removed. And so dogs that have rear dew claws like that, that's typically the ones that remove. The front ones, probably not necessary for the majority of dogs. Even if they do get a dew claw caught on something, it's minor things right now. I mean, I think this is still going back to like the pre-antibiotic era when we had dogs that were hunting for a living and we needed to take care of it. It's probably not necessary to do it, but it is also sometimes a show-related thing, and you have to, you know, remove dew claws or leave them on according to different breeds of dogs. So with the Golden, I think you could go either way.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Roxy in Costco, have you got a quick question?
Yes. I have a litter of puppies, and out of the six puppies, one has, it sounds like a respiratory chest cold. Just happened over the holidays, of course. So just wondering, do I let it cure by itself, bring it to a vet?
Take it in. A respiratory problem like this could be contagious to the other puppies, and it may interfere with their ability to nurse. It could be that they've aspirated. It could be a foreign body in the nose. It could be something infectious. So I think it's time to get that litter checked, and especially that puppy in particular, to make sure that we're not going to pass it on to the rest of the puppies.
Very good advice. Thank you, Roxy, for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we will be back with her. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Phone number to call, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Adam in Madison next. Adam, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I have a two-year-old lab that just got diagnosed with elbow dysplasia. He had some lameness, and then that's why we brought him in. And the vet is telling me that surgical options are maybe only a 50-50 that it would fix the problem, and I was wondering if there are non-surgical ones. I saw some braces online, and they're kind of expensive, and just trying to see what I can do to help my dog.
Yeah, well, I've been through it myself. My middle bulldog, Pete, had elbow dysplasia, and we know that this is something that is genetic, and if one of the things that I always encourage people to do when they have a certain breed of dog is to go to the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals, OFA's website, and do a little bit of investigating as to elbow dysplasia. They'll tell you about diagnosis and kind of the breed histories as to where your dog kind of lands. And Labrador Retrievers are definitely, you know, up near the top of having this as a problem. And I would contact the breeder and let them know as well, because they should probably have their breeding stock checked for this. It's a little difficult to sometimes diagnose before the dog are showing clinical signs, and it usually presents with lameness, and it's often both elbows that are going to be affected, even though they may only be lame in one leg. I know for my dog, the best way to get an answer was to do CT scans, and we found that both of his elbows were affected, and really the leaving it and having these loose bone fragments in there are just going to lead to arthritis. And so splints and things like that tend to rub. They're not going to get rid of those bone fragments that are in there, and I think your best bet is to have this surgically corrected. And my own dog had arthroscopic surgery, and it was really difficult to keep him quiet afterwards, because he came back home and felt so good. I remember the 2 weeks post-op where he had to have really limited exercise. when he wasn't in his crate or on a leash attached to me, there was always that opportunity that he would jump up or down off of a sofa. So we have three sofas in our house, and all of them we had to turn upside down. And so friends would come over and be like, why are your sofas upside down? But that was the easiest way to prevent him from being able to jump up and down. So the post-op stuff is really, really important to be able to help him. We also strongly recommend that these dogs go on joint supplements of some kind, whether it be a joint diet, fish oil supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, or any of those types of drugs. We usually recommend that they be on that kind of lifetime afterwards, and that your dog probably should not be used for breeding unless that's something that you know you've already taken care of. So yes, I think surgery is the way to go. And if your vet can't do or is you know not equipped to be doing arthroscopic surgery, getting a referral to an orthopedic surgeon that's able to do that, and I think you'll be really happy with the results.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thanks, Adam, for calling. Turning to Facebook for a minute, we've got a great picture from Karen of her dog, her white dog, Zoe, is getting ready for the Packers game against the Lions, and she's rescued Zoe from a shelter at age 6. She's now 7, and she's encouraging adoption of older dogs. Zoe is a sweetheart. And by the way, the Dr. Sandy show with me is her favorite show.
Wonderful. And, you know, I totally agree with rescue. I attempted to rescue an older bulldog with my last rescue, but instead they gave me a very defective puppy, which is fine, but you know, we were planning on getting a middle-aged to older one that needed a home, but we do have one of my three dogs is a rescue that we ended up getting at about seven years old as an older adoptee, and it's wonderful. He's approaching 11 now, and it's really neat to see these older dogs just the love that they can give, and how wonderful for you to do that. And it looks like your dog's nice and cozy under that Green Bay Packer blanket.
Yeah. If you have a photo and of your dog or cat, I hope you'll send it into our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We always love to see them. Colette on Facebook asks, what is the prognosis for her rescue Pomeranian, who is 10 years old, is being treated for Lyme's disease and has just had all its teeth extracted. He seems amazingly healthy despite all that.
I always get concerned when people say my dog is being treated for Lyme disease. In the human world, when we get exposed to the Lyme organism, a very, very high percentage of us become clinical. In the dog world, it is just the opposite. Only about 5% of dogs end up showing clinical signs of Lyme disease, which is going to be fever and lameness typically, or in some cases we will see kidney involvement. So just because a dog tests positive for Lyme on a screening test does not mean that it has Lyme disease. It means that it has been exposed. And so if your dog is not showing the classic symptoms of Lyme disease, and even if they are lame, rule out more common things. If it's a Pomeranian, luxating kneecaps, bad hips, those would be things that I would be looking at over an infectious disease like Lyme disease. But if you've got the teeth taken care of, boy, that's probably the worst thing for these little dogs, is having horrific periodontal disease, and that's going to add a lot of years to your dog's life.
That's
so
great.
Yeah. Yep.
Peggy wondered about bully sticks or beef stick dog treats. Are they good for dogs? She says her dog eats them so quickly, she wonders if they can be a hazard.
They can be, and that's the big problem, is anytime we're using any of these animal part toys, whether it be, they're not really toys, they're chew things, but like, you know, cow snouts or rawhide or anything like that, you need to know your dog. And this may not be an appropriate thing for Becky's dog to be able to chew on. To give you an example, I gave my middle dog, Pete, a rawhide chew yesterday, and I was with him, and that's one of the rules, is you never leave your dog alone. And he had that thing softened up and swallowed and was starting to have, like, and he ended up vomiting it up. all over a clean carpet, of course. And so, you know, that I just had to say, well, we can't use those anymore. And so that nice bag that somebody gave me as a gift has got to go off to somebody else because my dogs can't eat them. Remember that any of those animal part things that you may be feeding to your dog, whatever's been in the animal could be on the animal. And that means E. coli, salmonella, listeria, all of those things could be a possibility. So if you have young children or anybody in your household that is immunocompromised, having those things laying around where they may get picked up and put in somebody's mouth, like a young toddler, or if you're picking them up and handling them without thoroughly washing your hands afterwards, you could be putting yourself to some significant health risks. So I tend to avoid them if possible. Yeah.
All right. Marty in Verona up next with a question. Hi, Marty.
Hi. We've got a 12-year-old dog that's, to the best of our knowledge, she's a Beagle, Golden Retriever, Golden Lab mix. And she's a very mellow, calm dog, never gets very excited about anything. But about 5 days ago, her tail just was hanging straight down, and she won't, she can't wag it, and she was whimpering. We contacted the vet. They gave us a pain reliever for her. But it's been about 5 days. We're wondering if she should be examined or if this will resolve on its own.
Well, we do see this quite frequently, especially in the summer months with dogs that are jumping in the water. They'll sometimes call it swimmer's tail, where when you see dogs jumping in and their tail is straight out, and when it hits the water, it can cause a lot of irritation where the tail meets the body wall. It's also given the name limber tail, where it's just kind of hanging there. And it's we've seen this with dogs that have had been bumped in their back end. My own dog, this happened. I had a basset hound that liked to go down the slide at the park, and he went down the slide and kind of landed wrong on his butt and ended up having this issue with limber tail. I would recommend that you have your dog looked at, because if there's no known injury, then it could be something like, does your dog have a slipped disc or something that's causing some problems, and they'd be looking for other neurologic problems that may be going along with the limber tail. I'm not sure what type of pain medication was sent home. I'd be looking at probably, if your dog can tolerate it, one of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, because usually we need to have an anti-inflammatory to be able to take down the inflammation in that area to get the dog back and wagging again. So if it's been 5 days, time to go in and have that looked at.
All right. There we go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Betty in Dalton, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I have a yellow lab, and when he was born, I took him down to the UW, and he had a detached retina in his left eye, and we finally had it removed. He's 7 years old now, and back then they said he had ocular chondrodysplasia and that I should have put him to sleep. And I said, I got to give this puppy a living chance. And so he's 7 years old now, and he does limp once in a while. But I have him on this medication that has shark cartilage in and all these other things. I was wondering, and he does really well. And he's got a cataract in the other eye, so he doesn't see completely. Do these dogs live a normal length time as regular labs do?
Yeah, what you're talking about is dwarfism, and it's one of those uncommon things that we will see show up in various breeds of dogs. And the big problem is they've got these large size bodies with these very short legs, and so they're going to be more prone, similar to basset hounds and dachshunds and things like that, to having joint problems and arthritis. But if you keep them slender, they can go on and live a perfectly normal life. It's just orthopedically, they may be a little unsound, and it could cause, you know, be harder on their back and so on. So keep them slender, keep them from jumping up and down off of things. Consider getting little stairs or a ramp if he likes to get up on the furniture, and train him to use that. Regarding the eye issue, we will see congenital problems showing up in Labrador Retrievers that do not have this dwarfism as well.
Right.
And you know, it's they adjust to it. I have a lab that is one of my favorite patients that when she came in as an 8-week-old dog, it was like, yeah, there's something just not quite right with you. She was still visual at that point. At 12 weeks, she was clinically blind. And we ended up finding that she did have this retinal dysplasia that some of these dogs can get where their eyes just don't form normally. And it's unfortunate. It's something that the breeder probably could have assessed the breeding stock for genetically to avoid reproducing dogs that have this problem. She's blind, but is going to go on and lead a completely normal life, but just non-sighted.
Mm. Yeah, Kobe is just about as tall as regular labs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know. He's doing quite well, and he can hear the ball drop, and he'll find it, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. He'll play really well. My other question is that my husband is a hunting person, and we had two other hunting lab dogs, and the other one just passed away last year. And he wants to get another puppy, but he wants to know if that'll take away from Kobe, who's, you know, our main concern. If Kobe would get upset with this other puppy.
That is something that only time will tell. If Kobe gets along with other dogs that come over to visit, and so on, and it isn't not frightened by other dogs, having another dog come into your middle-aged dog's life at this point may add years to those senior years that are about to that he's approaching. So, I think go for it. If you want another puppy, this will be perfect because it will give him another playmate and somebody else that he can grow up with. And all dogs need to have that are visually impaired like this. Sometimes having that seeing eye dog with them, somebody that can notify them that somebody's coming up or, you know, that they can listen to where their tags are jingling. I've seen blind dogs go to the dog park and romp with their housemates, and you would never know they're blind because they're able to keep up with the other dogs, and they start learning how to follow them. So I think it's a great idea if you are up for getting another puppy.
Right. When before our other dog passed away, we had taught him left and right because of hunting. So before Kobe lost his eyesight, we used our arms like you do for hunting, left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I would tell Kobe left and right, and he can hear it, and he looks up like you can see my arms.
Ah!
So he's so intelligent, you know, that I'm just amazed.
That's so wonderful. It sounds like he is in a wonderful home, and you'll have to post some pictures of him for us.
Yes, I will do that. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much. Oh, yeah, I'd love to see Colby.
I know.
Post him up on
the one-eyed wonder right now. Yep.
The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, Betty. Tom in Appleton, hello to you.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Yes. I got a chihuahua, and then a lady told me a little while ago, because it had some black and white spots, and she said that it's a rat terrier mix with it. But I don't have a problem with her, but I have behavioral problems when anybody's around.
Yeah.
Suggestion.
Yeah. You know, this is something that can be a real problem unless it's addressed very, very early in life. And so often people will get these tiny dogs and they're carried around. They don't go to training classes. They don't get socialized to other people. And so they early on in life have very limited experiences. And then they start learning that you growl and snap and the boogeyman will leave you alone. And so in a case like this, this would be something that I would say, working with an applied animal behaviorist to teach you how to desensitize your dog to the approach of people. And so this may mean having someone that the dog may not feel that threatened by, maybe it would be another male human being or a female. You know, some every dog kind of has that's fearful will have different people that they react differently to, and having them approach at a distance while you're teaching your dog to sit and stay and take treats. But in the meantime, you really have to protect your liability. And so if you're going to be in a situation where there are going to be people that, especially young children, that may not know better, I would have your dog in another room or crated, or even consider going as far as getting a basket muzzle for your dog where you don't have to worry that what your dog's going to do because they can't hurt anybody. But those muzzles, not the kind that we use in the clinic that are meant to be on and off, the little, like the nylon muzzles, but the ones that look like what a police dog would wear. They can still take treats through, they can still drink and pant with. That way you can be calmer. The dog is not going to be a threat to anybody else, and it's going to kind of to take away a lot of the stress from the situation. But I think working with an applied animal behaviors is going to be your best bet in a situation like this.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Terry and Randall, we'll go to you next.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a almost five-year-old German Shepherd male rescue who came from a very abusive situation. And we had two other shepherds that he's kind of grown up with the last 2 years, but one has been put down recently. The other one was 12 and a half. We don't know how much time she has left, but this little boy has what our vet calls OCD. He jumps at anything shiny, whether it's on the ceiling, floor. He'll dig at it, and he'll actually make his mouth bleed trying to get whatever this shiny thing is.
Mm-hmm.
He's been on
Alprazolam. Okay.
Yeah, he's been on that. It didn't do anything to him at all. We've done Adapto. We've done chamomile and lavender essential oils. He is in training. My youngest daughter's taking him to training. And when he has his working collar on, he's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't have that on 24 hours a day.
Right, right.
So when he's not working, he reverts back to this crazy behavior.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating.
It is. And you know what? It's very common for German Shepherds. They are definitely overrepresented for having obsessive compulsive disorders. Well, we call them compulsive disorders, but we don't know whether they're really obsessing or not. Some of the typical ones that we're going to see are things like tail chasing. What you're seeing is going after flash or lights where they just attack them and will to the point where they're hurting themselves. One thing that you mentioned that your dog has been on some drugs, Alprazolam being a benzodiazepine, like a Valium-type drug, it's actually Xanax, is not an appropriate drug to be using for this. It's an anti-anxiety drug. It is not going to be helping the neurochemistry issue that is involved with dogs that have a compulsive disorder issue. I would be looking at having your dog on a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, the drug that we typically put these dogs on, is fluoxetine or Prozac, and that is the one that seems to help the best in these dogs. The Adaptil collar, again, it's a bitch nipple pheromone collar, maybe have some natural calmative effects, but is not going to take the edge off of your dog. I think the training is also helpful to give your dog some focus and something else that it can have attention on, and so good for you for going down that route. But I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, we need to have my dog on an SSRI, something like fluoxetine or Prozac, and that would be your first drug of choice. And it takes a good 6 weeks or so to start kicking in, so it's not going to work overnight. But I think that's probably going to be your dog's best bet.
And good luck, and thank you so much for calling. And we're just about out of time. Just quickly, Audrey in Kenosha just found a stray. What should she feed a stray?
Well, that depends on what species it is. A cat should get cat food and a dog should get dog food. But, if you found a stray and you start feeding it, remember that is going to become your pet right now.
It's a cat, apparently.
It is a cat. Okay. I would be recommending taking that cat into a veterinarian or the animal shelter and having it scanned for a microchip, because that cat may belong to somebody else. And this this way, it can get back to its rightful home. And so, you know, it's so good of you for looking out for this stray, but really try to see if you can find out who the owner is. And many, many cats are now microchipped, especially if they've come from a shelter situation.
And in the meantime, any cat food?
Any cat food right now, I would say. Just something to be able to keep this cat in this cold environment, getting some energy into it.
Sandy, thank you so much. You're back on January 24th. Look forward to that.
All right.
Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She will be back. Tomorrow at this time, we talk birds with Bill Volkert. So I hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.